Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today I'm talking to Alicia Burnett, who is a midwife, and we're going to be talking about maternal health, black maternal health, which is a topic which is very, very important. So I'm really glad that you agreed to do the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. So do you want to introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners, to anyone that doesn't know who you are?
Okie doke. So my name's Alicia Burnett. I'm a midwife. I'm currently on maternity leave, coming to the end of my maternity leave now. I'm also co-project lead of the All for Birth platform, which is an open access platform for anyone that's trying to have a baby who's pregnant at the minute or has had a baby recently or has children in their early parenting stage of life. I've written a couple of articles here and there about racism in maternity and midwifery education and in maternity services. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's me.
I think it's so nice to talk to you, because I was saying before we started recording that I've seen you about online and social media, and when I thought I really need to get you to come on and talk about this topic, because we know it's a really big issue. And I think that actually, if you're affected by racism in any aspect of life, you're very, very super aware of it. But I think there's lots of people who aren't affected by it, who have no clue that it is a thing. You know, I was talking to somebody only a few weeks ago, actually, and I don't know how we got onto the topic of racism. And she's white. I'm obviously not. And she was of the opinion that racism wasn't a big thing in the UK anymore. And I struggled to not bash my head against the desk, to be honest. So I was like, it really is a big thing still. And I gave her some of the stats on maternal, black maternal health. And her jaw just dropped. Like, she was like, how is that a thing? Like, I didn't even realise. And I think it isn't a widely acknowledged or known fact that if you're not white, your outcomes are far poorer. So would you want to talk a little bit about what are those experiences and what does that look like if you're not a white person and you're pregnant? What are the issues that you may come up against?
Before I answer, I'm going to make a confession. So during my midwifery training, I wasn't aware of the poorer outcomes experienced by black and brown women and birthing people. I was absolutely oblivious to it until I was in a lecture one day and there was a slide up and it showed the embrace stat of black women being 5 times more likely to die during pregnancy in the first year after having a baby. And I was frozen in my seat. I felt sick. I was thinking, you're black, how could you not know this? How comes your mum's never told you this, or any of your friends that have had babies, any of your family members? How could you be oblivious to this? So I wanted to know a lot more. And I found that there are actually people working in the UK here and now, and have been since the 90s, working to improve the pregnancy outcomes of black and brown women here in the UK. People like Mars Lord, Elsie Gale, they've been campaigning for years. And that didn't feature in my midwifery education until, I think this was my second or third year.
Wow.
So it wasn't, and it was only a single slide. So that was a huge shock for me. I'm of reproductive age. I want to have a family. As I said earlier, I'm on maternity leave, and it made me think about my future. What was my future going to be like, my reproductive future? And it made me think about my family and my friends, what was in store for us if these stats were so horrific. And so that was, I think, 2019. And then Five Times More came about, and they really had a huge part to play. Five Times More and Mars had a huge part to play in amplifying those statistics and increasing the public's awareness of these stats. So shout out to both of them, mm-hmm. Five Times More and Mars Lord, because more people need to know, particularly if you're going to work in maternity services, you need to be aware of these statistics.
Yeah.
It's not, how can you not know? In 2022, how can you not know? We've been beating this drum for so long. Mars has been on the news. There have been articles written about it. Five Times More have been in vogue. They've been in multiple publications. If you're a healthcare worker, if you're a birth worker, and you don't know about these stats in 2022, you've not had your ears or your eyes open.
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not, this knowledge isn't like a secret kept amongst Black and brown people. There are those of us that weren't even aware until quite recently that actually our statistics are poor in relation to white women. So that was the state of play when I was training. I wanted to find out more about why this is happening. How long has this been happening for? So it's been happening since the 90s, before that even. It's been happening since my grandparents came over, actually, on the Windrush. They're the Windrush generation. It's been happening since then. And I wanted to know what is being done about it, because these stats have always been rubbish and they remain rubbish. What are we at? We're like four times more likely to die now. But that's still, I understand, and I want people to know that I am aware that on the main, the UK is a very safe place to give birth. Yes. However, I'm still more at risk of a poor pregnancy outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You, Erin, are still more at risk of a poor pregnancy outcome. And we're people. We're real people. We're not just statistics. So I'm ranting now. I'm sorry. I've even forgotten the question you asked me. I just got on my soapbox and started banging my drum.
No, but it's important. And like, that's your question. So don't, I mean, you know, and I agree, because, you know, I think it's easy to spout these statistics and say these things, but, you know, we are individuals, we are people. These statistics are about us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine, you know, paying lip service to that, but we do need to see action. We need to see, you know, it frankly pisses me off. Really pisses me off when I hear women saying that they've been told because they're Black they should be induced because they're higher risk. Like, that you're not higher risk because your body is incapable of giving birth. You are mm-hmm. higher risk because you are being treated differently. And rather mm-hmm. than looking, so now I'm going on my soapbox now, but it really makes me angry. Instead of looking at the reasons why your outcomes are poorer, it's like, slap them with an induction, that will fix it. Like, that's not the solution. That's not the solution.
So Black and brown women, we're more likely to experience socioeconomic deprivation. We're more likely to have lower paying jobs. We're more likely to live in overcrowded housing. We're more likely to have less or be unable to afford even less access to fresh fruits and vegetables and healthy foods, and to live somewhere that's got an affordable gym or whatever nearby, to live in areas that have green spaces for us to go and ride a bike or take a walk. We're more likely to live in areas that are, we're more likely to live in undesirable conditions.
Yeah.
That's it. And if you live in undesirable conditions, you're more likely to have morbidities. You're more likely to have illnesses. It's not because you're Black that you've got X, Y, or Z. It's because you're Black, you live in this situation, and you have less access to healthcare, you have less access to green space, good food, good appropriate and adequate housing. So yes, you are going to be ill. So that all of that leads to poorer outcomes overall. Mm-hmm. However, if you've got a great job, if you're making loads of money, if you live in a fabulous house, if you've got lots of green spaces, you've got to take all the exercise in the world, you are still more likely to have poorer outcomes than white women.
Mm-hmm.
You could be on 60K plus. You could have a fabulous house, fabulous lifestyle, be super, super healthy, drink green smoothies every day, do yoga, and you've never smoked a cigarette in your life. But because you're brown and because you're black, you're still more at risk of having a poor pregnancy outcome, and you're more at risk of your baby dying.
Yeah.
And that's it. So what does that boil down to? That boils down to institutional systemic racism. We are accessing services that firstly may be inaccessible because a lot of the materials, if English is not your first language, a lot of the materials may be inaccessible to you because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do actually access these services, a lot of them are not built for us. So even going back to midwifery education, a lot of the text, a lot of the illustrations, a lot of the visual aids that we use to teach, that are used to teach us, they are not reflective of diverse skin tones.
Yeah.
If you're taught about mastitis, for example, mastitis appears red. Your breast will appear red. However, I've had mastitis and I sat on it thinking, oh, I don't know what this is. I'm not feeling great. I felt really, really rubbish, but my breasts aren't red. So I must just be a flu or something. Even though my breast was on fire, really, really hard, really, really firm. I was like, what is this? I was like, this is mastitis, but my breasts aren't red. So it must be something else. And I thought, what are you doing? You bang your drum so much about things presenting in darker skinned people in different ways. So what the textbook says, you have mastitis, get on it, treat it. And it's only because of that I had that moment that I didn't end up in hospital, because I was really on the edge. I was really, really unwell. And it's because I'm a midwife, I have that privilege, I have privileged that knowledge, I have friends that are lactation consultants, I have access to knowledge and expertise that I didn't end up in hospital. But what about the black woman who doesn't have red breasts, who doesn't have the appearance of red patches or blotchiness on her skin, on her breast, but she has the fever, she's feeling generally unwell, she's unable to handle or touch her breast because it's so sore. What about her? She comes into A&E or into triage and ends up on IV antibiotics separated from her child. I know I must sound like really passionate. My partner's over here looking at me like, oh, calm down, love. But it's because I've seen it.
Yeah.
I remember looking after a lady who came and she was sweating, dripping with sweat. The fever had really taken hold. Her breast was so sore. She's on IV antibiotics. Oh, I couldn't think of anything to say to her because she just looked so distressed and so in pain and she wanted her baby. But when you admit mum, or the person that's just had a baby, babies can't always come with them. So her baby was at home having to be given formula because they've been separated, because whoever had been seeing her postnatally wasn't able to recognize, oh, this looks like mastitis, because her skin was darker. Stuff like that. Now that I'm a mum myself, I used to just be a midwife, but now that I'm a mum, I'm a midwife and a mum. I have two hats on at all times, and it's made me more compassionate. It's made me more aware of the fact that this woman, this birthing person, they are both people. They both come from somewhere and they both have different individualized conditions. And I have to be attuned to whatever their needs and whatever their situations are. Okay, ranting again. I'm so sorry, Erin.
Rant away. What about things like guidelines and policies? Because I know for a fact that lots of policies and guidelines come from research, and research is primarily done on white men, actually, to be honest. I know that lots of studies are not actually even done on women. So that must play a part as well, right?
It does. Like, take the BMI. The BMI was based on white European men. And whether your BMI is over a certain number, you may or may not be admitted to a birth centre.
Yeah.
You may have to go to the labor ward. You may be tested for gestational diabetes based on it.
Mm-hmm.
You may be automatically considered at higher risk of X, Y, and Z because of your BMI. And it's not even based on people that look like you. So yes, that is one aspect of it. Definitely the research that a lot of what we do. Okay, there's the ethical side of it. It's not ethical to do to conduct research on pregnant women. It's not ethical.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is not even based on women at all at any stage of their lifespan.
Mm.
For example, in some places, the values that they do, that they use to determine whether or not you've got gestational diabetes, aren't even, they don't apply to pregnancy. So you're looking at values that apply to outside of pregnancy. So if you're over this outside of pregnancy, then you've got diabetes. But hey, I'm pregnant. What about that? Have you taken that into consideration?
Mm-hmm.
Some places do, some places don't. But that's just another example of where the policies that dictate your pregnancy experience, they're based on evidence that isn't actually applicable to you in your pregnant state or you as a black or brown person.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And then what about, because we can't ignore the actual racism within the NHS,
mm-hmm.
which absolutely exists. I mean, I was reading the Black Maternity Experience report, and, you know, even just scanning that and looking at the comments from individuals, I mean, I'm literally lost for words for some of the things that I've read in that report, you know, comments, and they're not things that I've never heard before. I get people DM me all the time on Instagram. One woman messaged me and said, my consultant, this is in the UK, my consultant has told me I should elect for a cesarean because he told me, but because I'm Asian, my pelvis is too small and I won't be able to give birth. Anyone that's listening to this can't see your face right now, but your face is exactly the same face that I made when I read that. Like, I wanted to throw my phone against the wall. I was like, oh my God, like, that's completely untrue and be completely racist. Like, and pelvic shape and pelvic size, like a lot of the opinions around that is based in racism. So racism plays a huge part in those experiences and those outcomes of non-white people, right?
I can give you a personal experience. So my daughter was persistently OP from about 24 weeks. She was OP occipito posterior, so back to back. And OP is known to be, if you believe that everyone has the same pelvis shape, every woman has the same pelvis shape, you could believe that a baby that's OP is pretty much impossible to birth without repositioning through 100 million trillion VEs, or without spinning babies or Rebozo or whatever technique you want to use to reposition that baby.
Mm-hmm.
You could be led to believe that OP is suboptimal fetal positioning for every woman.
Yeah.
If you believe that every woman has the same pelvis shape. Just not true. It's just not true, because my baby was OP persistently. Yes, I had the worst back pain of my life, but she came out OP. They tried to turn her so many times, but she came out OP because that was the best thing for her.
Mm-hmm.
It's not impossible. It can present a problem for many women, but because I'm a black woman and my pelvis has a particular shape, not all black women have the same pelvis, by the way, we're not all built the same. Yep. It's not Build-A-Bear. but my particular pelvis accommodated an OP baby perfectly and did do from a very early gestation. So yes, the idea that because you're Asian, because you're black, you can't, your baby's in the wrong position for your pelvis. There are differences, individual differences in the way that our pelvises are shaped.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, can you imagine you're built wrong. You can't do this because your baby is not in the right place and your body's shaped in the wrong way. Excuse me? And if I had known more about the differences in pelvis shape when I was birthing my daughter, I wouldn't have consented to all of those VEs.
Yeah.
She keeps twisting that way for a reason. There's the most space in that diameter, so just leave her alone.
Mm.
But yeah, the premise that every woman has the same pelvic shape is flawed. Mm. And even amongst so women from that are Black, there are also differences there. There are individual differences there. Every person's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot.
What other kind of common experiences do you hear that people come up across when they're pregnant? Because I'm sure there are like fairly consistent, you know, themes in terms of negative experiences.
Sadly, you're right. During pregnancy, when we were being taught about complications during pregnancy, sometimes you would come across materials that would say, for example, a risk factor for preeclampsia or gestational diabetes is ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
So because you're Black, you're more likely to have gestational diabetes or you're more likely to develop preeclampsia. Preeclampsia has all of these different risk factors. For example, if you've had a baby, your last baby was born 10 years ago, that's a risk factor. A new partner's a risk factor, the same partner's a risk factor. So many different risk factors, and race, Black race, was a risk factor for preeclampsia, one of these slides. No other explanation, nothing else. And I feel that pathologizes certain ethnicities.
Yeah.
Or assumptions are made, oh, because she's Black, she must have this, or she must have that. And I see it. I see it during pregnancy, but I also see it during birth, and I also see it in the postnatal period. So if I remember, there was an Asian lady in labor. I've had a child recently. It hurts. It really hurts. Oh, she's making all that noise because she's an Indian princess. How about she's making all that noise because it hurts? Because she's a human and she's feeling all of that. She's feeling her baby navigate her pelvis. How about because she's crowning?
Mm.
Nothing to do with her ethnicity. Mm. I've seen Black women being declined or being refused breastfeeding support because of this, what they do in their culture, they'll be fine. Actually, Emma Pickett, who's a lactation consultant, love her. She recently made an Instagram post about the rates of breastfeeding in, I think, West Africa up to the year of two being like really, really high, like 90 something percent. And I was like, wow, because I'm sure that's not the case here, because yeah, we're Black, but we transplant us somewhere else that is not our countries of origin. And you may find that the society that we're now living in isn't supportive of you of term breastfeeding. Yeah. And that your baby's 9 weeks old and people are looking at you like, well, when are you going to stop doing that then? Just because things are one way, or the statistics say something about people that live in one particular location, doesn't mean it's automatically applicable to everywhere else that those people then move to. Yeah, so I've heard that. What else have I heard? Oh, this one really, really, I felt, I didn't know what to do. In fact, I didn't do anything. I wanted to just run and hide and take the woman with me. So we had a lady come in who was very, very modestly dressed, a Muslim lady, and she didn't want to have a VE. She didn't want one. She didn't want anyone. She didn't want to remove her clothing. She just didn't want to be touched there. And I remember the midwife saying to her, open your legs. You slept with your husband, didn't you? You opened your legs and open your legs now. And I just, the cruelty. And I said to the midwife, can I go and get her husband? Because the power imbalance when you're a student and you've got a midwife who has say so about whether or not you passed or not can really bind your tongue. And it bound my tongue. And all I could think was, okay, I'm scared of you. So God knows how this woman's feeling. Can I go and get her husband? And that's what I did. And all that talk stopped. All of that talk stopped. She then said again, I don't want a VE. And with her husband there as backup, not saying that she needed a man to back her up, but she needed someone that wasn't, she needed, that's what I mean. When you are an ethnically marginalized person, you need backup. You need backup because you're powerless. When you're in pain, you can be blind with pain. You need backup. Whether you're black, brown, whatever, you need backup when it comes to giving birth. But particularly in those situations, when you're an ethnically marginalized person, you do need someone to be an advocate for you. Someone that cares about you, has your best interests at heart. And I couldn't be that person. I wasn't that person. To this day, I feel great shame about that, because she needed me to tell this midwife to stop. She doesn't want this. This is assault.
But this, I guess, that leads us back to the systemic and the cultural issues that are in the NHS, because, you know, I'm always in awe when I get student midwives message me and they tell me stories about things that have happened, you know, when they're on placement, or, you know, their passions, because it's hard, right? It's hard to be that person to speak up against a very well qualified, you know, long practicing midwife or an obstetrician or a consultant when you're a student. And I feel like, you know, it's not encouraged to think autonomously or to question authority. It's a really, really hard, thing to do. And I think that's one of the issues that is ingrained in the system.
It's been allowed to go on for so long because there are people, like I was that day, that don't say anything, that just keep quiet, because they could, especially if you're of a marginalized ethnicity yourself, it's hard to speak up against racism anyway. But when you're black or brown yourself, and you're seeing someone being racist to a partner, to a family member, to a woman, to a birthing person, you're like, wow, if that's how you're treating them, how are you going to treat me? I know what you're doing is wrong, but I'm afraid. And it really is really hard. It is really hard, but it is the right thing to do.
So you mentioned having a good advocate. What would your advice be to somebody who is not white and is pregnant, who really wants to make sure that the experiences that they have throughout their pregnancy and birth are protected?
I'll start off by saying that nothing you do can 100% guarantee a positive outcome.
Yeah.
Sometimes with all the best intentions, things don't always go the right way. But as a black or brown person that is expecting a baby, you do need to be aware that you are at increased risk of poorer outcomes. It's scary. And initially I thought, why are people going around spouting these statistics? This is frightening stuff. This is really, really frightening stuff. Yes, I'm 4 times more likely to die, but there's nothing being done about it. So what am I to do with that information? But it's important that you know, because you should use that information as much as possible to embolden yourself to ask questions. So, for example, if you know that you're more at risk, you and your baby are more at risk of poorer outcomes, ask questions. So when you're being sent home, and you're being given the discharge talk, and they're like, if your baby looks yellow, you should let your midwife know or your GP. My baby is of a very, very deep, dark complexion. How would jaundice present on my baby? So ask those kinds of questions. Whatever you're told, ask them, okay, so how does that apply to me, my ethnicity, my cultural background? How does what you're saying relate to me? Don't be afraid to ask those questions, because those answers, the answers that you're given, could potentially save your life.
Mm.
It's a huge responsibility, but I'm sad to say it's a huge responsibility, but it's one that you have to take on when you're pregnant.
Yeah.
I'm really, really sad to say.
Yeah. I think as a parent in general, like, you're, regardless of race, you're that person's, that small person's advocate. And it's something that I've learned the hard way. You know, I've got three kids, and I learned very early on, in very difficult circumstances, that you have to ask those questions, and you can't always take that first response from a GP or someone from A&E, because sometimes they're wrong. And you do have to be that person to go, no, you know what, I'm not leaving until you look at my child properly, or I'm not leaving until you explain to this to me properly, because no one else is going to be that advocate for your child other than you. So I think it's a really, really good point.
And that's why it's also important to have your birth team. Your birth team doesn't have to be your mum. If you know that your mum falls apart in times of stress,
mm-hmm.
I don't think she's the right person to be on your birth team. You need someone that knows what your birth preferences are, that knows you, and will stand for you when you cannot stand for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So my birth team consisted of my partner, and I also had an independent midwife who I've known for years and who loves me and I love her. And when I was hemorrhaging after having my daughter, my partner took the baby, and my friend, my independent midwife, held my hand the whole time and was telling me what was happening. I was completely out of it, hosing blood. But I knew that my daughter was safe, and I knew that I was in good hands because she was telling me everything that was happening, and I knew that I had a really good team of professionals in the room working on me. It was like being in an OSCE. So OSCEs are like, there are certain skills you have to master in order. It's one of the requirements of passing the degree. So breech birth, hemorrhage, neonatal resuscitation, and shoulder dystocia. And I could hear the things they were saying to each other going, okay, I'm hemorrhaging badly. This is going all wrong, but they're doing all the right things. So you need an advocate. And another time was my anomaly scan. I really wanted my independent midwife with me, and the sonographer wouldn't let her in. Partners only, she said, because of COVID. And yes, COVID is real. COVID is a thing. But if there's only one person allowed with that pregnant person in the scan, and this is the person I've chosen, admit them.
Yeah, it doesn't matter who they are.
It doesn't matter at all. This is another thing of blindly following policy. Mm-hmm. We could have been a lesbian couple. You didn't know. You didn't ask. So there was that. So I was on the table being scanned, praying to God that they didn't find anything, because I've had previous experience of congenital anomalies. So the anomaly scan for me was, I couldn't sleep the night before. I had high blood pressure because of the stress of it. And I was alone. My independent midwife barged her way into that room and sat right next to me while I had that scan. She advocated for me because she knew that I needed her there.
Mm.
That is who you need on your birth team. The people that will stand for you and you cannot stand for yourself.
Mm.
And if you're really deep into labor, you may not be standing at all. So you really do need a good team. Also, there are loads of, well, not loads, but there are resources that are tailored to Black and Brown women. So Five Times More, they have their six steps, which are designed to help reduce maternal health disparities. And they're just prompts for Black and Brown women to do things like speak up for themselves. If you're not happy, speak up. For example, if you don't like your midwife, it's your right to change your midwife. If you don't like your hospital, it's your right to change hospitals at any stage of your pregnancy. Seek a second opinion if you're not happy. I did that in my pregnancy. I'm telling all my business today, Erin.
You're mine, that's why. It's not that long ago.
So I was admitted to an antenatal ward for like 6 weeks with threatened preterm labor. So I started to have niggles at 25 weeks, and I ignored them for like 24 hours thinking, oh, it will go away, and it didn't. She was actually trying to make her entrance super early into the world. And they wanted to put in a stitch. And they were like, okay, and we'll come back tomorrow. And then it came back again. And I was like, this is not tomorrow. I was going to have 24 hours to think about this. And he came back with a consent form. We can do it today. What? I need more information to make a decision. I can't. So miraculously, a midwife friend that I have turned up, and she actually worked on the team that specialise in preterm labour, preterm pregnancy, super, super preemie babies. And she talked me through everything. I wanted to know everything down to what material is that thread made out of. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know it all. So I sought a second opinion. And based on the full amount of information that I had from the doctor and from the midwife, then I made my decision. So it's okay to ask for a second opinion, because that's your baby and that's your life.
Mm.
You're a parent. As soon as you become pregnant and you decide, yes, I'm going to keep this pregnancy, you're a parent there and then. So all those heavy decisions do weigh on you. So you do need all the information possible. They also say to do research, find an advocate, and trust your gut feeling. I didn't feel that the stitch was the right thing for me there and then. I trusted my gut feeling. She ended up being induced because she was post-dates.
She got too comfy.
So I didn't need the stitch in the end. Of course, everyone's situation is different. And their last step is to document everything. Also really important, especially if you've got questions that you want to bring to your appointment, especially it's really important to write them down, write down the name of the person you're speaking to. And if you want private care, I found that they want, like, so I was a VBAC. And I had to have it documented in my notes, the risks of uterine rupture and things like that. If I wanted to have a VBAC, I needed that documented in my notes if I was going to still be cared for privately. So that's just something to note.
Mm.
And also I had to get my previous maternity records as well if I wanted to enter into private care. But even if you're not looking to get private care, it's always a good idea to have everything written down. So God forbid anything does happen, it helps with your reflection, because mm-hmm. you can go over things over and over again in your mind. But if it's written down, makes it a bit easier. That just brings me on to my next point. If you've had a poor experience, poor pregnancy or neonatal experience, my advice, and this is why I sought out private care, is to, as far as possible, try to talk through your previous experience or seek counselling or a specialist, birth trauma midwife or specialist, to talk through those experiences before it comes to you actually giving birth.
Yeah.
Because it can help shape the way you ask questions. It can inform the questions you ask, and it can inform your birth plans.
Mm.
So I just want to shout out Ilian Morrison, who's Mixing Up Motherhood on Instagram. She's a birth trauma specialist midwife, and her content really, really helped me. Illy, you didn't know that I was using your content to support me throughout my birth, but I did. And it helped me to formulate my birth plan, to build my birth team, and to have the birth that I wanted. So that's another thing I would say to Black and Brown women. Try to unpack your trauma before you get to the stage where that trauma happened, as much as possible. And I've just got two more things I wanted to say. Know your options. So what are my options for pain relief? Can you just break down the hierarchy of pain relief, of analgesia for me? Because I had it all. When I got there, I thought, okay, I just mobilize. Then it really started to ramp up. Got in the shower, I was on the gas in there. Yeah, can I have the codeigamol, please? Can I have the pethidine, epidural? I went through everything as the pain ramped up, because as I said earlier, I had an OP baby and the back pain. Woo!
Way more intense.
It was like, you're gonna break my back. It was a lot. But because I'm a midwife, I know what my options are. But for the person that isn't a midwife, ask them to break down your options and put it on your birth plan. see, I would like this, 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 and this. If this doesn't work, I want this. And you can always change your mind on the day.
Yes. Like,
it kind of shows that you're aware of what my options are. Because unfortunately, there's this misperception that Black women are able to tolerate pain better than a white person or a person that isn't Black. It's not true. It's just not true. I was praying, calling for my mom. I'm not even that religious, and I was calling Jesus. The pain was a lot, and I had an epidural. I don't think I could have, because I was induced, so I had the drip. This girl was stubborn, super stubborn, Erin. She wasn't interested in coming out, and I wanted to avoid a C-section, so I agreed to an induction. And so, yes, advocate for yourself and make them aware that you know what your pain relief options are. And recently I read something about there being a shortage of epidurals. So before you get to, so in your third trimester, ask them what the situation is with that. So are you able to accommodate an epidural if I ask for one? Mm-hmm. And if they aren't, what are my alternatives? Or maybe you even have to consider giving birth somewhere else. It's always good to know your options for anything, pain relief, where you can actually have your baby. So just ask those kinds of questions. It's always good to know. And my last point is to use social media judiciously. If you're pregnant, you may not want to be consuming negative birth stories all the time. It can really just ramp up your anxiety. Yes, just use it judiciously. I'm not going to tell you who you should follow and who you shouldn't follow. You just know for yourself who you vibe with and who you don't.
You know, if you follow me on Instagram, you know that I have opinions, but I'm not going to say them on the podcast. But I have opinions. I wholeheartedly agree with you on that point. Definitely.
You can drive yourself mad.
It's funny because, like, I mean, I agree with everything you've just said. Like, literally every point that you've just made are points that I cover in all of my courses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sage advice for any pregnant person, quite frankly. You know, the fact that you should document things, I mean, that's something that I tell every single one of my clients. I go one step further, and rather than documenting things, I actually recommend that everybody records the conversations. You know, get your, not like video, but just get the dictation app out on your phone and record the conversation. Doesn't have to be a confrontational thing. Doesn't have to be a negative thing. You know, you're pregnant. You're not going to remember everything. You want to listen to it later. That's a perfectly valid reason. But I think it does discourage and head off some of that negative language, or some of that kind of, it just makes the person you're talking to a little bit more conscious and aware of how they're talking to you and what they're saying. So I think it's a really, really good point that you should be kind of documenting those interactions, making notes on things, because unfortunately it is necessary sometimes, and you're not going to know it's going to be necessary until after the fact, which mm-hmm. is why I always say to everybody, record it. If you don't need it, you can delete it afterwards.
There's nothing worse than, some appointments can be quite daunting and you can really be quite apprehensive before you go in, and there's nothing worse than dreading an appointment, going in and it just all going left, and then you leave the appointment thinking, oh my god,
yeah,
I've got an induction appointment, I don't even know why. So it document everything, and I had never thought of recording.
I mean, it's perfectly legal, and it's completely, you know, understandable. You know, if your birth partner's not with you, you know, trying to relay information secondhand to them is hard. Having that recording is a really good idea. I advise it even more as you approach the end of your pregnancy, to be honest, because once you get to approaching 40 weeks or going over, you know, the conversations turn to more interventions. They can become more difficult conversations. You might be having conversations with consultants, and those can be more difficult. They can be more tricky. They can be more negative, depending on the consultant that you're talking to. So I really recommend recording those conversations, and hopefully you can bin the recording afterwards, but it's always better to have it and not need it.
yeah, you're right. You're just in the moment, you're listening, but you may not be taking everything in. And then you've got someone on your, probably got your mum, and then your partner and your sister. So what did they say then? You're like,
and to be honest, like when you're pregnant and afterwards, I mean, my oldest is 10. My brain is still fried. I'm going to be honest. Like I could be mid conversation with somebody and just the thought just flees my brain and it's gone. And I can't think of what I was saying. So, it is a good idea to kind of record those conversations and be able to play them back, because you're not going to remember everything that they said, to be honest.
It's so important. The information is so important for you to retain, and you're just not in a state to be able to, your decision-making capacity can be impaired, especially if you're in labor and having to make all of these huge decisions that could potentially affect the life of you and the life of your baby. Yeah, it's a lot.
And if the other benefit of recording these conversations is that if you do experience racism, or you experience negative language, or you are spoken to inappropriately, you have a record of that then to submit with your complaints. Because I would really recommend putting complaints in if you experience that kind of behavior, because things don't change unless we speak up and we give that feedback to the hospital. So it's always handy to have that to back up, you know, your feedback or your complaint to the hospital.
Yeah, that's a good point. Definitely would make complaining easier. I'm learning new things today, Erin. Love it.
So you mentioned you'd written some articles, which are they on All for Birth that people can access?
The articles I've written, so I've written one about racism in nursing and midwifery. That a lot of this stuff is behind paywalls, that's the thing. So, and I've also written about Black and Brown student midwives' experiences. That's the piece I'm most proud of, because Black and Brown student midwives have lower attainment rates, so they're less likely to get a first class degree in midwifery, in higher education, full stop, actually, and their attrition rates are higher, and the number of Black lecturers in UK higher education institutions is paltry, really, really dire. And I actually got voice notes from Black and Brown student midwives recounting their experiences whilst training. There was one student who, she's Black and she's Muslim, and people would express disbelief at her being in the clinical setting, like, oh, what are you doing here? Oh, that's unusual. Or how to recognise signs of deterioration in Black and Brown women and babies, that being completely omitted from learning materials. I found that listening to those voice notes really helped to inform me writing that article, because I was a Black student midwife and I had my own struggles. So it was really important for me to be able to amplify the voices of others without identifying them, because that's the thing. You're very much in, there's very much a power imbalance when you're a student and you just want to finish your degree and get out of there. But there are individuals that, if they don't like you for whatever reason, and the reason could be racism, you may never get to achieve your dream of becoming a midwife.
Yeah.
I wanted to quickly say, I've been thinking about what has been done to improve the outcomes for pregnancy outcomes for Black and Brown women. And there are things that have happened, but there are just one or two that I wanted to, because you may not be aware of them, so I just wanted to make you aware, you and the listeners. So over the past couple of years, there's been the introduction of a specialist midwife. So they're, I've written it down here, equality, diversity and inclusion midwives. And there isn't like a fixed job description for these new midwives. But for some of them, part of their role is to improve the care experiences and outcomes of ethnically marginalized communities, and I would love to speak to a few of them about how that's going, because the job's been running for, or they've been in post for, I think maybe 2 years now, or a year, I don't know how long exactly, but I'd like to know how that's been going for them, and how have the statistics in their particular areas improved. And I have noticed that some of the information, for example, women that are affected by gestational diabetes, there's been a cookbook put out by, I don't know which trust it is, but there's a cookbook for women that are affected by gestational diabetes that features recipes from South Asian and some Black communities. So that's been something that they've tried to improve the outcomes of women affected by gestational diabetes in that way. I'd love to know how that's going.
Mm.
I'm always in the background looking and reading and watching what's happening.
Yeah.
But my dream is to become, I don't know, not a consultant or anything, but just like, so you've put in this quality improvement strategy in place. How's that going?
Yeah. It's accountability, isn't it? It's holding people accountable for the things they say they're going to do. Because otherwise, like I said earlier, it's lip service. There's a guideline, there's a policy that we need to change the statistic. So let's put these things in place. But is it actually doing anything? That's the crux of it, isn't it?
And if these things are working, I would love to have a hand in like disseminating them, because a lot of the time it's like, oh, this is a problem. We know it's a problem, but what can we do? Okay, what's been tried? Mm. What's worked? Let's get it out there.
Yeah. Okay.
Some of these midwives are working hard. Mm. Like, could you imagine being that one midwife responsible for that, for improving the outcomes of Black and brown women and babies? That's a huge task. I would like to know what kind of support's being offered to them. If you really care, how are you supporting these midwives?
Mm.
And is this intervention working? If it's working, how are we going to make it more widespread? Let's do it. Come on, let's go. You know? I want to have another baby eventually. Let's let this one grow up a bit more. But when I have my next child, I don't want to have to be so fearful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we should put a call out on social media, try and find some of these midwives and get feedback from them. They can do it anonymously.
You know, I want to do a PhD. Maybe that could be like part of it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So where, I feel like I could talk to you for ages about this, but we should probably wrap it up, because otherwise we'll be talking until like the kids have gone to bed. So where can people find you online if they would like to follow you and all of your wonderful ideas and content?
So I've been a bit quiet on Instagram because having a baby was a lot.
Keeps busy.
Yes. So on Instagram, I'm _ Alicia Burnett. And on Twitter, I'm not really that active on Twitter at the minute, but I'm A Burnett_RM on Twitter. I've got some things that I'm working on, but I'm not ready to talk about them just yet. But if you're a birth worker, if you're a midwife, if you're pregnant, trying to get pregnant, if you're a parent, mother, father, however you wish to identify, I'm working on Author Birth. And we're trying to turn Author Birth into a resource that anyone who either wants to be pregnant or looks after people that are pregnant or has children can come and just find out evidence-based, accessible information about everything from preconception care to what does your child like to read? What does your four-year-old child like to read? Anything. It's a really, really broad scope that we're trying to cover. But if anyone wants to contribute anything to the Author Birth platform, we love to do social media takeovers. We love to do lives. I really want to grow that community with a diverse range of people. Anyone doing anything in the birth world, come on over. So that's All4Birth, ALL, the number 4Birth, on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
I'll put the links in the in the podcast bio so that people can click through to them. Thank you so much for today. I really enjoyed talking to you. And when you're ready to talk about your projects that you've got, you know, going on in the background, then maybe we can do another podcast and you can fill us all in on all your exciting projects.
That would be amazing. Thank you for letting me rant and rave.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.